Okay, it is 8:30, and so I want to welcome everybody to the second of the part of the amazing escape of the Mir Yeshiva to Shanghai. A pleasure to welcome so many of you, and Dr. Shapiro, always the pleasure. As I mentioned last week, we have close to 200 of his talks online on the Torah Moshe website on Gedolim from right to left and everybody in between. It's really a wonderful opportunity if you want to listen to many of the shiurim. They're all online. Of course, many shiurim during the week. And I think before we start, I just want to make mention, it is Yom HaZikaron this evening in Israel, here too, I guess it's beginning. And I think it's important. I assume most of us here are not in Israel. And we remember the great sacrifices that so many have made so we could have a state. And it's very important to keep that in mind. And please go out tomorrow night, we can celebrate Yom HaZikaron. So with that introduction, Dr. Mark, bakasha, it's all yours.
To pick up where I left off. And here we go. You see, by the way, on the right, there's a chat. You can always type something in there. I usually only get to it, unless it's an emergency, I get to it at the end of the class. Just a word of apology. There was a problem with the Zoom, and we only got to put 100 on last class. It's supposed to be 500, and we'll see if we get over 100. We'll see. If there's a problem and it doesn't get over 100, then maybe I'm going to be doing it. I'll have to stop for a minute. I'll do it on two screens, but we're at 94. So Rabbi Kelman, he'll be watching it, and we'll see if we get over. Okay, before we begin, I just want to respond. Someone emailed me a question. I mentioned the Mir Yeshiva as the oldest yeshiva in the world, and someone said, well, what about Volozhin? Well, I mean, Volozhin was established in 1802. We said Mir, we think, in 1815. But there's a lot of yeshivas established before Volozhin also. You had yeshivas in Rashi's day. What I meant by that was, which is the oldest continuing yeshiva? And that would be the Mir Yeshiva. There is a Volozhin yeshiva that was opened up after the war in Israel, but it really has no continuation to the prior Volozhin yeshiva, whereas we'll see the Mir. It's the same yeshiva. So that explains that. Let us begin. I want to say, Rabbi Kelman, you'll watch it. We're at 100. If it doesn't get over 100, then you can text me. And maybe there's a problem, and I'll put it on the other screen.
I'll wait a minute and see what happens. Okay.
Okay. We're at 101, so we're okay.
Okay. Baruch Hashem.
Very good. Okay, I'm going to pick up exactly where we were last week. We have a lot of very interesting things to get to. I remember I couldn't recall who the Treasury Secretary was under Carter. It's Blumenthal, Michael Blumenthal. It's actually Werner Michael Blumenthal. He's from Germany. So if you go to Shanghai and you're in the ghetto area, if we can ever do that again, you will see a sign in front of the house. There was a whole big celebration. Okay. Before we begin, one more thing. We were speaking a lot, and based on the conversations that I had, the email from people in correspondence with me, a lot of people found it very interesting. Some were shocked, surprising, disappointed. I explained my position last class, that you can only judge people by the circumstances they had. And as we heard from Rav Yecheskel Levenstein, the smart play was not to go anywhere. In fact, there in 1937, the Soviet Union had asked people who were not citizens yet from areas that they had taken over earlier, do they want to become citizens? And those people who didn't want to become citizens or had asked to leave, they had been sent to Siberia. So there's a lot of fear about this. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. However, it becomes even more interesting because it wasn't just the yeshivas we spoke about who made it to Vilna. Communal rabbis also made it to Vilna from both German and Soviet occupied territory. And Rav Chaim Ozer told them to go back to their communities, that this is the responsibility of a rabbi to be with their community. This position, which in retrospect, of course, turned out to be a mistake because they would have all been killed, was actually opposed very strongly by the Kovno Rav, Rav Avram Dov Ber Shapiro, one of the great Torah authorities of the day, Rav Ochanan Wasserman, and the Brisker Rav. All of them disagreed with Rav Chaim Ozer's position. Their understanding was that where we are right now, the rabbi has no responsibility to stay and put his life in danger. Of course, the Brisker Rav himself had left Brisk and had come to Vilna. And then we spoke last class how he got out. His wife and three children were still, three of his children remained in Brisk, and they were martyred in the Holocaust. So these are tough things. Actually, the question of whether to flee from German territory to territory under Soviet rule also did not have an easy answer. The Brisker Rav told people under German control not to go to Soviet control, because he says it's a lot worse over there. You had the communists, and they knew what that was about. They still had this perception of the German army in World War I. Rav Simcha Zelig Rieger, who was the dayan in Brisk, Yitzhak Zev was the Rav there, he said that this is a question which we don't have an answer for. There's no Torah ruling on this topic, so he couldn't decide whether it's better to be with the communists or better to be with the Germans. In retrospect, of course, better to be with the communists, and the people who would have been sent to Siberia, as some were, they survived many of them. Okay, let's pick up where we were last class. I think the last time I said was that there were some students who, for one reason or another, did not wish to make the journey to Japan, or even apply for the exit visas, which was the decision, as we know, of all the other yeshivas. There was even a yeshiva meeting of a number of the other yeshivas, and they all agreed not to apply for the visas because they thought that it would bring the NKVD down on them. But there were students, even of the Mir, who didn't. I'll just give you one example because he's a famous one. There was a great, when you talk about students, we already saw that Blade Malin was like 33, 34 years old. So some of these students were older. But there was one student, and this was actually written about in Yateid Ne'aman. His name was Rav Yona Karpalov from Minsk. He was one of the great students of the Mir. And I'm just reading here. Let me just read you what Rav Aryeh Finkel said about this. It was in Yateid Ne'aman from Rosh Hashanah, Erev Rosh Hashanah 5767. He told the story about how Rav Yona Karpalov didn't want to leave because he was worried that it was very dangerous to, first of all, dangerous to go for the visas, dangerous to actually go into Soviet territory. They could put you in Siberia once you're there. And Rav Chaim Shmulevitz was asked why he was not saved, and his answer was because he remained alone and was not part of the yeshiva, and he was martyred. So there was this conception they had that if you were with the yeshiva, then you would be saved, but those students from the yeshiva, and think about what they did. They went along with Rav Aaron Kotler and the others said they unfortunately did not make it. And we saw, and this is, I think, also the last thing we said, by the time the other yeshivas realized what was going on, it was too late, although some of the leaders were able to get out. They're just like some of the leading Zionist, secular, religious, whatever, to get out. Rav Aaron Kotler, he leaves in February 1941. He leaves Kovno, and he goes across the route we're going to talk about, the Soviet Union, on a train that had about 100 students from different yeshivas. Now, how did they arrange to leave? There was a student, I mentioned him last class, he was in Telz actually, but he too was in Kovno. His name was Nathan Gutworth. And there's a family connection last week, maybe even now as well. One of the people listening is the stepchild of Nathan Gutworth. It was just, they didn't know I was gonna speak about him. I just did. So he was Dutch. There might've been at the time, they say, between 5 and 10 Dutch citizens in the entire Lithuania. It wasn't actually a popular place. When things started going downhill, he, being Dutch and knowing that there were Dutch colonies, both in Curacao and also the East Indies, all over, he thought maybe that's a solution. We can get out, because you couldn't get out of the Soviet, you couldn't travel through the Soviet Union if you didn't have a visa to a foreign country. Forget even about Japan now. You couldn't even get out of the Soviet Union, so you needed someplace to go. America wasn't giving, couldn't get anything into Palestine, so where would you go? So he came up with this idea. In Latvia, there was a consul who was really like a real consul, and Gutworth was in contact with them, and he asked him about Curacao. And the consul said, well, you don't need a visa. to get into Curacao. So that's a great thing. But the stamp that they would give said no visa required. Entry will only be permitted at the discretion of the governor of the island. Well, that means that there's no guarantee you'll be let in, and people won't even go if they don't have any guarantees. And this applied also to Dutch citizens. If you get there, odds are they let you in. No reason not to let you in. But if you have 200 Jews coming on a boat, who says they're going to let you in? Gutworth asked the consul in Riga if the local consul could just stamp it no visa required. That is, leave out the other part saying that entry will only be permitted by the approval of the governor of the island. And the consul in Riga said that he has no problem with it. The local consul, you had a consul in Kovno. What's the consul doing in Kovno? He was a man who worked for Jan Zwart. I don't know how to pronounce his name. He actually worked for Philips radios and all this. He was a businessman and he was stationed there. So he was just the representative, the civilian representative of the government. And he was very friendly with Gutworth. He would have newspapers sent from the Netherlands. And when he was done with them, he'd give them to Gutworth, because who else? He'd send them to him. Who else would be interested? Who else could read Dutch? So he said he would do it, and he was told there's no problem doing it, and that gave Gutworth the idea. Then they came up with another plan, though. You're going to get out. How are you going to get out once you get to the Soviet Union? Sugihara. Here is the famous, let me show you a picture of the famous Sugihara. Hold on a second. Got to share the screen. Let's see. I got a lot of screens I want to show you later, so I can't. Got to find the one I want to show you. Show all windows. Okay. Too many screens. I got to wait till you see the stuff. Okay, this is the one I will show you here. So here is Sugihara, the famous picture. So they go to Sugihara, and Sugihara also agrees that he'll stamp it. What's the problem? You have to pay a little bit of money in both places. And the deal was you had to have you had the transit visa. It's a transit visa for 10 days in Japan. And you had to have a place that you're going to. And Japan didn't have a problem with this. And so Gutworth then tells some of his friends, one in particular at the Mir Yeshiva. He told other people as well, but they weren't interested, that this could be the solution. Because you get the Curacao final visa, you get the Japanese transit visa. Now, the plan always was, it was never go to Curacao, because there's no guarantee you can get in. The idea was once you get to Japan, then you figure it out. You can go somewhere else. It turns out some of these students were able to also get Canadian visas, all sorts of things. But the important thing they said was just to get out. That was another reason why the people in the yeshivas thought that this was crazy, because where are you going to go? You're going to end up in Japan. Maybe they'll send you back to the Soviet Union. Who knows? But that was the plan. It began with Gutworth. So as I said last week, Gutworth really has to be given the credit for him, because, he's the one who came up with this idea. He's the one, they went to Sugihara. Throughout the time with the Mir Yeshiva and the others, Sugihara was issuing these visas, but he wasn't doing anything against the rules of his government. It was all above board. Later, however, Sugihara starts issuing visas for humanitarian reasons. That is, when the people did not have any evidence that they had money and they could support themselves, and they didn't even have evidence of a visa for a final destination. And this was in direct violation of the instructions given to him from Tokyo. You can read all about it in Hill Levine's book that I showed you last week, In Search of Sugihara. So when you speak of Sugihara as really one of the righteous of the nations, which he is, it's really not about what he did for the Mir. That was just, he just was doing his job, and he had approval for that, actually. It was later for other people who didn't have this visa going forward, that's when it became... really, he did something which hurt his own career, even destroyed perhaps his own career. So the Mir students, they gathered them all together. They got all the visas. They got all the passports together. They brought them, and they were all stamped. In fact, Sugihara let one of the Mir students stamp them with him because it was a long process. They have to go through a few hundred of them. That's just the students, about 325, not to mention the family members of the Rosh Yeshiva and the other teachers, etc. And then they had to present it to the Soviets. And that was the real problem, not getting the visa. The other Rosh Yeshiva opposed getting the visa because they thought, first of all, the Soviets might know they'd see you. They had to wait on these big lines in front of Sugihara's consulate there. By the way, Sugihara, what was Sugihara doing there? There are no Japanese living. He's the only Japanese person living in Lithuania. He was a spy. That's what he was there for. His whole job was to pay attention to what the Soviets were doing, what the Japanese were doing, and to collect information. His cover, of course, he functioned as a consul, but his job was to collect intelligence. And the Mir Yeshiva, it wasn't just the Mir Yeshiva, by the way. We'll talk a little bit about Chochmei Lublin. There's a figure, the Amshinover Rebbe, we'll get to. He had a great deal of influence on the Hasidic students at Yeshiva Chochmei Lublin, and he insisted that they follow this path. And then you had some Lubavitchers that we'll speak about. So you go to the Soviets, the NKVD, they have to give you permission to leave. You have to go to INTORIS and take care of it. Why would the Soviet Union allow yeshiva students and others with the Sugihara visas to pass through Soviet territory and leave the Soviet paradise? Granted, these were not Soviet citizens. The ones who lived in Lithuania were in a real difficult situation because unless they got some forged documents, they could not leave because they were regarded as Soviet citizens. These were Polish citizens, but still, why did they let? It seems that it was a money calculation. Each one who left had to pay a significant amount of money. The figure given in some is 870, some is 180. I went on the inflation calculator and that comes to, with today's money, $3,300. Now you see how expensive that was. That's why they had to raise the money in America. We spoke last class about the money being raised by Rav Kalmanovich. Even on Shabbos, he raised the money and it was sent to them. So it's an enormous amount of money and most of it was sent from America. In the end, incidentally, Kranzler, who wrote a whole book on the Jews in Shanghai, the figure he gives is 2,400 Sugihara visas. So it's a lot of visas. Of the Mir Yeshiva students, we're talking about 320 or so, they paid this. They paid the money, and this entitled them to a first-class trip for what will be, I think they say, 11, 12 days on the Trans-Siberian Railway to make it all the way to the end to Vladivostok. Here's, let me show you here where we're, where they're going on their journey. Well, first, here's Vladivostok. Let me make it a little smaller so you can see where we are. So all the way at the end of the Soviet Union, transfer from all the way over here, all the way there. Now, incidentally, on the journey that they took, they actually they stopped at one of the times. The train would stop at various times. This is, if you can see it, Birabajan. That's the Jewish area that they set up for Jews to live. And you can read in the memoir literature about the Jews that they met there. And the plan was when they get to Vladivostok, they then were going to go to Japan. They take the boat there. Where they would go, as we'll see, is Kobe, right over there. So, but let's continue on the story. So they were actually traveled first class. When they went to Moscow, they stayed in a fancy hotel which served wonderful food. There was nothing really they could eat other than eggs and bread. But they, all the memoirs speak about how they were treated like kings. And then they got on the train in Moscow and continued on the whole time. It's because they paid INTORIS, that was the Soviet travel agency, an enormous amount of money. One person who didn't join them was Rav Lezer Yehuda Finkel, the Rosh Yeshiva, who we spoke about last time. He got an exit visa and he got an entry visa, I should say, into Eretz Yisrael. And Rav Herzog helped with that. And we have two versions of why he didn't go with them. One was that he thought if he would go to Palestine, he'd be able to better assist the yeshiva because they want to bring the whole yeshiva there. In a letter, he says that the doctors forbid him traveling. So on the train. In either case, he did not go. We know that the Mashkiach, Rav Yecheskel Levenstein, was upset with this. How can you have a yeshiva when the Rosh Yeshiva doesn't go with you? It's like the captain deserting the ship. Well, at least we know that that's what he thought at the beginning. Whether he continued, I don't know. But Rav Lezer Yudofenko, he leaves, and therefore the yeshiva is led by his son, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, and the Mashkiach, Rav Chesel Levinstein. So they journey to Kobe. Let me show you the map again. They get to Vladivostok, no problems. They journey to Kobe. Everything was all taken care of, paid for. There we are. Let me make it a little smaller. You could see. So they come from over here into here. And there was a community there. There had been a community in Japan for a good 30 years, and the community was very helpful to them. They set them up, and the yeshiva begins functioning. They arrive in January and February of 1941. Now, as we know, there never was any intention for the yeshiva to continue on to Curacao. The problem was that what were they supposed to do? They had only a 10-day transit visa. So how could they not continue on? What's going to happen to them? Well, fortunately, the yeshiva was able to obtain extensions over and over again from their visas until eventually the Japanese decided just to let them stay here. How did they obtain these extensions? Well, first of all, there are people in Kobe who had good ties with the government. But really, there was one man in particular. His name is, I'm going to pull up his name here. So then I'll show you a picture of him just so you can spell it. Hold on, let me share the screen again. Every time I go out here, it's here it is. Okay. His name is Setsuzo Katsuji, but really he goes by the name of Abraham. And this is an unbelievable story. I will tell you, you can look it up later on Wikipedia, but let me tell you about who this person was. There was a Japanese professor from a long line of Shinto priests who had converted to Christianity, was very attracted to the Bible, and wasn't happy with Christianity, and began to be attracted to Judaism. He taught himself Hebrew, he learned Hebrew, and when the yeshiva students came, this was his first chance to see what he regarded as authentic Jews, and he became very close to them. He journeyed to them there, and he had a connection to people in government, and he begins to advocate for them. Not only does he begin to advocate for them, he also starts traveling around cities of Japan speaking about the Jews. He even publishes a book explaining who the Jews are and speaking out against anti-Semitism. The Germans were trying to put anti-Semitism into the press and into the public mind of Japan, and he's going against this. He also serves as a translator. It's interesting because I don't know what language he spoke to the Rosh Yeshiva in, and I have to think, I mean, maybe some of them could speak a little German and he spoke German, or maybe there was a translator into English. I'm not sure. But just to give you an example, he served as a translator at the famous meeting that after a few extensions, the leaders of the Japanese government, including the foreign minister, they wanted to actually meet some of these yeshiva people and find out who they are. And what happened is you have a meeting, and you see over here in Tokyo, in the Professor Katsuji's over here, in the middle is the Amshin over Rebbe. That, by the way, is Rav Moshe Schatzkes
from Mark. Just I'm saying it didn't come out on my screen. I don't know about other people, but your screen didn't share.
Ah, screen doesn't share?
Neither
did
it. It did not share.
Right.
So yeah, if you just
Let me hold on. Let me try it again.
Okay.
It could be because it's Osar HaChachma, but let me try again. Let's try one more time. If not, I have another way of sharing. Tell me if you see this.
No.
No.
No. Okay, so what I'm going to have to do is I'm just going to, as we're talking, I'm just going to, I can very easily come up with a solution because I'm just going to save it to my desktop, the page that I want to show you. And I'll just save this right now to my desktop and you'll definitely see. Let me just take care of this. Interesting. I thought that everything was shared automatically, but let's see now if you can. No, you won't be able to see it, I think, even there. You can't see anything, correct?
Yeah, I don't know. If you put it on Google and then share it through a Google document, maybe that'll...
No, what I'm going to do is I'm going to, because I do want to, show you, I can show you on Otsar HaChachma, maybe the screen. Let me just open up right now quickly. Terrible. While we're doing this, by the way, I'll say that, we spoke about Lithuania as being neutral, and therefore no one thought that it would be touched. It wasn't just Lithuania. I looked up all the neutral countries that were invaded: Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg, Denmark, and Norway. So lots of people had problems. Okay, I'm going to now, hold on, I can show you the screen. I didn't pick it up, but it was easier to show you the screen. So let me just get the page number so I know now what page I need to show you. It's, I'm sorry about this, Aleph Shin Nun Beis. So then I will be able to take care of this. I thought it's on my screen, so I don't know why it shouldn't be on your screen. But now I'm going to tell you. Now you should be able to. Can you see now?
No. Yeah. No, I see you.
I'm going to show you now. Hold on.
Yeah.
This will work because it's just from the internet. Once I get see where the screen is. Okay, tell me you can see this now, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Aleph Shin. So let me show you. This comes from the book on, I told you last class, the 3-volume book on the Mir Yeshiva. And there's a whole chapter on Katsuji that you see there. It says, Gerrit Tzedek. In the end, he ends up converting to Judaism. After the war, he ends up in Brooklyn. He's supported by people who knew him in Japan. And he converts to Judaism, but I want to show you he arranges, you can see in here Hebrew writing, he learned how to write Hebrew. There's a famous meeting in Tokyo where Katsuji is the interpreter, and here's the picture. And there he is on the right. That's after the war in Jerusalem with Rav Chaim Shmulevitz. But here is Katsuji. Here is the Amshinova Rebbe. The Amshinova Rebbe, a very influential person in Japan and later in Shanghai. He made his way also to Vilna, and he immediately knew that we have to leave. And he tried to convince people to listen to him. On the right here, that's Rav Moshe Shatzkis. He was in Japan. He wasn't in Shanghai, just like Rav Aaron Cutler wasn't in Shanghai. Many people made it to Japan, and from Japan, they immediately left to America. They went through San Francisco. Rav Moshe Shatzkis is known, though, because he taught at YU, Yeshivas Rav Itzchak Elkanan. Not only did he teach there, his son also was a Rosh Yeshiva there. He's the Lom Jerov. In fact, smicha exams for a while were done with the Rav, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Shatzkis, and Rav Shmuel Belkin. At this meeting, famously, which was attended by the foreign minister of Japan, they were asked, the Rosh Yeshiva, the rabbis there were asked, as a few others as well, why do the Germans not like you? Why do they hate you so? And the Amshinova Rebbe said, it's because we are Asiatic and they don't like non-Aryans from Asia. And that, we're told, had a very positive influence on them because then they understood, you know, that the Jews are like us. At least it influenced certain people. Things later went bad for Katsuji because he was accused of helping the enemy, the pro-German group, when they gained ascendancy. He was put into jail, and he lost all influence. And as I said, he would later convert to Judaism. He wrote a book called From Tokyo to Jerusalem, and he's buried in Jerusalem in Har HaMenuchos. And but as I said, he suffered difficult financial circumstances later in life, and it was there in the book. It has a letter there signed by various people who were in Japan asking for donations to help support him. There were always two factions. There was the faction of the faction that wanted to be allied with America and really didn't want war. And then there was the pro-German faction. Let me stop sharing this now. We're going to have to go back in a few minutes, I guess, for that as well. Why did the Japanese allow the Jews to stay there, and why did they turn a blind eye? It seems that it's because of the faction that was not the pro-German faction. That faction would only come into play later. There was a faction, as I mentioned, in Japan that, I guess you could say it's an anti-Semitic feeling, but it's anti-Semitic in a good way. In other words, they thought that the Jews had enormous power, especially in America. And they knew that the Treasury Secretary was Jewish, and they did not want to alienate the Jews in America because they wanted them on their side. They also remembered what happened in 1904 and 1905 in the Russo-Japanese War, when great American financier Jacob Schiff gave enormous loans to Japan. And when Japan won that war, Schiff was given two big awards, and one of them was even presented by the emperor, which is very unusual for a foreigner to meet with the emperor. So there were these feelings, either feelings of very positive feelings about Jews, or a sense that the Jews are powerful, and we don't want to make trouble with it. That was the reason why the Jews, the Manchuria was controlled. We'll speak about Manchuria soon. Manchuria was controlled by the Japanese, and they let Jews in, because they thought it was good to have Jews on their side. It's like what we think is anti-Semitism sometimes is very different. When I was in, I saw this also when I was there personally in China, but we had, my parents had this Chinese student who came and stayed with us once, and he said he likes to meet Jews because he knows they're all rich and he wants to find out what their secret is. So if that was an American, say it, but I heard the same thing when I was in China last year. Someone was saying, "Oh, I love Jews. I love Jews. They're all so rich and they can achieve such great things. I want to do that." So for an American to say it, might say, "Well, Jews are all rich. We don't like it." But, you know, if the foreigners think that about the Jews, like maybe it's good. In any event, that's what the situation was there. Now, in the end, the situation got to be where they did not want to allow the yeshiva to remain in Kobe. And instead, they decided to move it to Shanghai, the Japanese government, which also was under Japanese control. Shanghai was originally an international city. You didn't need a visa to go into, but Japan was in control of it. And there, so the yeshiva was transferred to Shanghai, and there the yeshiva would join approximately 20,000 Jewish refugees who had come from mostly from Germany and Austria. So their time in Germany was short. They by September 1941, they were out. But it was of historical significance because it led to a great halachic debate over where the dateline should be placed in accordance with Jewish law. Of course, you need a dateline. Just look at a globe and you'll see, and you need to, the day has to start somewhere. The question is, where does the dateline, where do you start? Where does the day begin? Where does Shabbos begin? When does it begin and end? Most halachic authorities believe that Shabbos in Japan should be celebrated on Saturday. And that was the practice of the local Kobe community. They had a community there for 30 years. And they had always celebrated Shabbos on Saturday. On the other hand, the famed Chazon Ish, he was of the opinion that Shabbos on Japan should be Sunday, because it all depends where you put the dateline. So when they first came to Kobe, they observed Shabbos like everyone else observed Shabbos, the Mir Yeshiva, that is, on Saturday. However, Rav Lezer Yehuda Finkel, who was in Israel, Eretz Yisrael, he had been speaking to the Chazon Ish, and the Chazon Ish told him that it's not the right day. The right day is Sunday. So he sent a telegram to, I believe it was a telegram, not a letter, to Kobe, And it's a famous scene. Rav Levenshtein, not only does he announce when we're observing Shabbos, he shows up Shabbos morning in shul wearing tefillin, showing them that this is the, we're changing the day. And he announces that Shabbos is not today, it's tomorrow, in accord with the Chazon Ish's opinion. And this then became the practice of the Mir Yeshiva students. However, this was not the unanimous practice. First of all, you had the local Jews. Second of all, the Lubavitch Rebbe had ruled Saturday is Shabbos. And that was the opinion of the Gera Rebbe, of pretty much everyone, other than the Chazon Ish. Everyone held Saturday is Shabbos. In one of the, and so there was conflicting times. When do you observe it? There's a book by a man named Leitner, who was one of the yeshiva students there, and he described it as follows. These halachic disputes, namely the dateline, with their resulting problems, led many refugees to set aside a two-day Shabbos for various degrees of Shabbos observance. What he means by that is it got to be crazy that, you know, how can you have that these yeshiva students celebrating Shabbos and these on Sunday? They agreed that everyone would celebrate their day of Shabbos, but the other day they would refrain from Torah violations. So for instance, we would celebrate it on Saturday, and on Sunday we would rabbinic violations we would do, but Torah violations we wouldn't. Also, he says, while one group of scholars would recite Kiddush welcoming the Sabbath on Saturday night, another group simultaneously observed the Havdalah ceremony in farewell to the departing Sabbath. So even if we're going to keep Torah prohibitions on Shabbos, we're still going to be making Havdalah Saturday night at the same time they're making Kiddush. We've never had a situation like this where in the same community people were observing Shabbos on a different day. We could have had that problem in days of Rav Sadia Gaon about, you know, when the new year is, Rosh Hashanah. But so it's an amazing thing. Let me read you also something else about this. In the book I mentioned last class, this book, the three-volume study of the Mir Yeshiva, on page 499, tells us something which is really interesting, I think. Two things he tells us. He says that, and he's quoting testimony of someone, that the people who were observing, let's say, Sunday, just Torah prohibitions, or Saturday, just Torah prohibitions, very soon understood why Chazal, the sages, instituted all these rabbinic prohibitions, because in the days that they were not, you know, in the day that they were not careful on rabbinic prohibitions, almost, you know, without thinking, they were led into Torah violations. In other words, if you know what's, today people don't know what's a Torah and what's rabbinic, but these are Talmidei Chachamim. So if you start ignoring the rabbinic prohibitions, you're led into Torah prohibitions. So it was a good learning lesson for them to understand the value of the rabbinic prohibitions. He also mentions that the Amshanov Rebbe came up with a solution, but only a few people adopted this, that people, that they should observe both days 100% as Torah prohibitions completely. I guess, I mean, we do Yom Tov, you know, we do two, even 3 days, but every week it's a bit of a problem. But there were a few who did that. Now, Shabbos isn't such an issue. We'll see about Yom Kippur. That becomes more problematic. Today, it's, I mean, Shabbos is observed there on Shabbos, on Saturday. That's the, that became the accepted position. I don't know, maybe some Chazonish followers would do it differently, but for example, Rav Yashiv, who really was the final authority for the Haredim, he disagreed with the Chazon Ish, and he said Saturday is the day that you observe it. Now, this matter of the halachic dateline, we could spend a lot of time on. I spoke about it in the classes under Mrs. Zalman Meltzer. I think Rav C.P. Pesach Frank also, because he had an interesting position with C.P. Pesach Frank. He held there is no halachic dateline, that is, not from the Torah. It's just whatever, wherever you pick it, that's the dateline. And he had a very good proof. You know, Chazal knew that the world was round and they understood this, and yet nowhere in the Talmud does it say where the dateline should be. How is it possible that the sages will not tell you about something so basic? So for Tzvi Pesach Frank, that's the obvious proof. And Rav Zalman Meltzer, although in practice we don't know about if Rav Zalman held this, but Rav Tzvi Pesach certainly did, that you can set the dateline wherever you want. So I don't need to go into that now. What I do want to point out, though, is something that people don't realize. What I've said up to now is found in the various books on the subject of the Mir, etc. But I want to tell you something that's not found there, which I think is interesting. I may preface it by saying, you know, until the Chazon Ish's opinion, there was never any question of which day to observe Shabbos. Already in the 19th century, great Gedol Yisroel, Rav Yosef Shalom Nathanson, Rav Shmuel Moliver, had all said that you observe it on Saturday. There was also a rabbi in China, in Harbin. Let me show you, let me pull this up in a second, and I'll show you that where we're talking about here. I'm going to pull up on my Google Maps here for a second. There was a Jewish community, let me get the screen here so you can see this, in China, in a place called Harbin, from really the end of the 19th century. There you see the city of Harbin. Let me make it a little smaller so you could see exactly what we're talking about. Oops. Right there. Why was there a Jewish community there? There were many Russians. They built a railroad there. It became a settlement of Russians. And the Jews went as well. And there was a rabbi, a very big Talmud Chacham. He was there from 1913 until his death in 1949. His name was Rav Moshe Aharon Kislev. And he served, he was the rabbi of the so-called Russian community. Those were all the Jews who were there. Just to give you some examples. By the way, Ehud Olmert's parents are from Harbin. You can go there now, and you can see the old synagogue. Dara Horn, if you know the name Dara Horn, the author, she wrote something in the, I think it was the Jewish Review of Books a couple issues ago, about her trip to Harbin. There's an Israeli there who works at the university and serves as a tour guide. But in the 1920s, the Jewish population was over 20,000. And as late as the 1940s, there was still a Jewish day school in Harbin. What drove the Jews out was the communists. You couldn't stay there. But I want to show you a couple things about, and to explain to you why this is, he is important. But I'm going to have to go to the screen because I have all the pictures. But so let me just pull it up here and you'll see the title page of the book. Because unfortunately, for some reason, my screen is not showing, so I need to find it for you here. Show you, Rabbi, there's a lot of books, as you see, named Imre Schaefer. So here you see the title page of Imre Schaefer. This is a book published after the war of his drashot and other things. Notice, look what he's called, Harav HaRashish or Mizrach HaRachok, the chief rabbi of the Far East. And that was actually the title he was given. There was a gathering in 1937 of Far Eastern Jewish communities called by Japan. They met in 37, 38, 39, and he was officially given the title. He was the one that poskened the Kobe Jews turned to him when they reached Japan because they wanted to make sure that they're doing right. They didn't know about Yosef Shalom Nathanson or Moliver or anything. And he told them, you observe it on Saturday. Just to tell you about Rav Kislev, who was a student, incidentally, of Rav Chaim Moshe Grzinski. This volume, which is called Imre Schaefer, has drashot. It includes a typical drashot, but it also includes eulogies for the Chafetz Chaim and Rav Kook. Rav Kislev was in Volozhin together with Rav Kook, and he mentions a question that Rav Kook asked in Volozhin that everyone was amazed by. He also has speeches he gave on the 20th and 25th anniversary of Herzl's death, so he's a Zionist. He describes how, thanks to Herzl, many Jews who were entirely removed from their heritage and ready to assimilate were once again feeling pride in being Jewish. It's similar to what Rav Soloveitchik says about the state of Israel. Also included in the book is he has a whole speech about the Balfour Declaration, about the 1929 victims of the pogrom in Chevron. And he also has a speech in there. You can check it out at the opening of the Hebrew University. Now, many know about Rav Kook's famous speech in which he is said to have said about the university, Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah, out of Zion goes forth the Torah, which is completely false. He didn't say it about the university. He said it about Jerusalem, although the certain extremists in the Haredi world continuously use it to attack him, even, and they know it's false. But there were figures who did say that, and Rav Kislev applies the verse, Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah, to the university. And if you read what he says, it's like he thinks that this is going to be a center of Torah. It's like it wasn't clearly he didn't know what the university was. Now, he also published a volume of responsa. Let me show you that. This is, it's called Mishperei Yam. You can all see it. It says, Kolel, it has Shelos and Shuvos Ba'arbachal Ke'er Shulchan Aruch by Aaron Moshe and Shmuel Yosef Kislev, rabbi of Harbin and the area. This is the only sefer on responsa volume. In fact, it's the only halacha volume ever published in China. It's not the only, I'll tell you why, it's the second volume of responsa published by a rabbi living in China, but it's the only volume ever published in China. Rav Gedalia Felder from Toronto, I'll mention, because we have Toronto people here. In one of his books, he cites it, and he says that this is the only volume on halacha ever published in the Soviet Union. Now, why does Rabbi Felder think that? Because look at the title page. He sees this. It looks like it's Russian. It's published 1926. That's during the communists. So he assumes it's, and he sees the street, Rehov Kitotsky or something. He didn't know that Harbin is China, not the Soviet Union. So that's, I think, of interest. Just to let you know, in case because someone's going to ask me, I'll show you. There was another volume published of Tshuvot, published by a rabbi in China, but it wasn't published in China. It was published in Jerusalem. Here's the title page. It's called Yedei Eliyahu. This is from actually the Chazan of, his name is Eliyahu Yitzchak Chazan, but he also is the Chazan in Shanghai at the Sephardic Synagogue. So we'll get to that. It's the O.L. Leia Synagogue in Hong Kong first, and then he's in O.L. Rachel in Shanghai. We'll speak about both. Both of these synagogues still exist. O.L. Leia, if you've been to Hong Kong, that's the big synagogue in Hong Kong. It begins as a Sephardic synagogue, and now it's Ashkenaz. Nusach Sfard, actually, but Nusach Sfard is Ashkenaz. Just the Hasidic version. So when I was there, I got to talking, and the people had no clue as to why the shul would be in Hong Kong should be Nusach Sfard. There's no Hasidim there. Why would it be Nusach Sfard? I think the answer is obvious. It began as Sephardic, real Sephardic, Iraqi Jews. And then when people begin to come in, they want to turn it Ashkenazic, but decide to make a compromise. Nusach Sfard. But it remains to this day, the Olea Synagogue is the only Ashkenazic, I believe, and no one's contradicted me, including the Mashkichim I've been in Shanghai, the only Ashkenazic shul in the world that has Birkas Kohanim every single day is the Olea, outside of Israel, is the Olea Synagogue in Hong Kong. And that's a holdover from the Sephardic when it was a Sephardic show, until probably the 1930s. This volume of responses is of interest also because it's the only volume of response I think ever published, which, take a look at this, has nekudot. It has vowels. Usually we think that people who read responses don't need vowels, but for some reason he published it with vowels. And so let us go on. Let's continue with our story. Actually, before returning to the Dateline issue, let me tell you one more story about Harbin that happened with Shanghai students, but Shanghai students from not from the Mir. And of course, we're going to get into what they did in Shanghai, how they live there. A fascinating story, but you had students from Chachmei Lublin, who were these are Hasidic students. This is a portion of the yeshiva. They make their way to Shanghai as well. And they have two Hebrew volumes called Gibor Yechayo, but also an English volume. It looks like this. Can you see it? From Lublin to Shanghai. Artsville translated this in 2012. And it's authored by David Mandelbaum, introduction by Yechiel Ben Sion Fischoff. We mentioned him last week. And it's an abridgment of the story in the two-volume Hebrew book. It's called The Miraculous Exile of Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin. They tell the following story, which I'll just share with you because I think it's such a strange story to tell. how in 19, David Mandelbaum, the author of it, he's a rav in Israel, a big time chacham. He tells about his father, that his father and a friend in 1943, who were in Shanghai, both decided to go to Harbin. Why not? It's China. It's controlled by the Japanese. And they go there and they visit the library. And while they're in the library, they find on one of the tables Isfas Emes. Isfas Emes is an important work for the Gerach Hasidim. And the two students were very surprised, since how does Isfas Emes end up in Harbin? And the book tells, this is the story the book has. I'll read it to you in English. It says, how did the Holy Sefer reach this far-flung place, they wondered. Who would have expected to find a volume of Isfas Emes in Harbin, China? Wishing to spare the Sefer from disgrace, they placed it into one of their bags and slipped away from the university, delighted at their find. If I could, I would show you they end up taking it back and they reprint it, and on the title page says on it, Shanghai. I don't know if I can get to that. You couldn't see my screen. What I find is amazing is, how is this not thievery? They go to Harbin, they go into the university library, they see on one of the tables there a Isfas Emes. Presumably the library acquired it from one of the local Jews who donated. Or perhaps someone was learning it, and while the students were in there, he went to the restroom or something, or he left it there and was coming back the next day. Because remember, there's a whole community of Jews there. And he comes back and there's no Sefer anymore. You read this and you see that they felt like they had the right to take it, because the book it does not belong in Harbin. We had these problems before because at the seminary in New York, JTS, they had to put in the metal detector there, because people were coming in and just walking out with the books thinking that they don't belong there. It's just an incredible story, and I'm shocked that they included it. It's not like the Vatican or something, which confiscated Jewish books, and there really are books. China wasn't interested in doing that. In any event, they take the book and they reprint it. And in the biography, the story of the Lublin Yeshiva, they even have a copy of the letter that they sent to Rabbi Kislev when they sent him the book. Okay, so let me get back. I want to tell you, and this might be the last thing we say today, tell you something which isn't known about the Dateline. And I think it's sort of it's important to set the record straight. It's well known, at least this is what everyone says, that when I told you this as well, when the Chazon Ish's letter arrives, Rav Chesed Levenstein told the yeshiva to follow what the Chazon Ish said. But that's not really the story. Rav Chesed Levenstein writes first to Rav Kislev, asking him what to do. The issue came to a fore about Yom Kippur. That was the real issue. It turns out that the yeshiva students were all gone. They were able to make it to Shanghai before Yom Kippur, although a few of them, believe it or not, still were remaining there. The question was, well, what day do you do Yom Kippur? And the Chazon Ish sent his telegram saying what to do. Other rabbis in Jerusalem gave a different day. Rav Chesed Levenstein writes to Rav Kislev asking him specifically what to do with Yom Kippur, and he includes a letter, a copy of the Chazon Ish's. Chazon Ish also sent a letter, which is the telegram earlier, or maybe it was revealed to Funkel with his reasoning. It's interesting that even after receiving the Chazon Ish's letter, Rav Levenstein still felt the need to consult, even if in the end he didn't go along with it, with Rav Kislev. When it was Shabbos, he did his own thing. But when it came to Yom Kippur, he was not prepared on his own to follow the Chazon Ish without at least consulting with Rav Kislev, who was, as we know, regarded as the Marad Asra of the Far East. Not only that, Rav Leib Malin. We spoke about Rav Leib Malin. Rav Leib Malin, he was a student, but a student leader. He was in his 30s. And he is the reason why the yeshiva students left, because he led the revolt, basically. It was him who pressured the Rashi Yeshiva, him together with other students, to leave. If it was just for Rav Lazer Yudofinkel and Rav Levenstein, they would have remained in Vilna, as we spoke about last week. And we have Rav Kislev's letters to both Rav Leib Malin and to Rav Yechesel Levenstein, first, and affirming that you cannot change the date and Shabbos is on Sunday. It's interesting as well that in his letter to Rav Chisel Levenstein, and remember, Rav Kislev is a student of Rav Chaim Ozer, but this was a long time ago, Riasmicha from, I should say. He had been in Harbin since 1913. He didn't know who the Chazon Ish was. Let me read you what he says. He says that I wrote to you, this is to, he's writing to Rav Leib Malin, and he says, he said, I replied to you with a telegram that you do not change anything, don't change Shabbos and holidays and Yom Kippur. And then he says, Ubipnesha b'Shabbos higiduli, over Shabbos they told me, ki Rav Chazon Ish Adam Godohu, umeherabanim amtsuyanim bartzino kedosha, avarti sheni saldivarav. He says, over Shabbos, I was told, maybe these are yeshiva students, there's all sorts of people in Harbin, they told him that, you know, the Chazon Ish really is a great rabbi. Had you been living in Vilna, then you would have known that if you were a yeshiva student, because the Rav Chaim Ozer, although the Chazon Ish had no official position, Rav Chaim Ozer, by the early 30s, was consulting with the Chazon Ish on everything, and he was known that he was a great Torah scholar. But if you're living in Harbin, who's the Chazon Ish? The Chazon Ish wasn't publishing stuff by his name, and even the stuff he published wasn't getting there. So here he tells us that since I was told over Shabbos that the Chazon Ish is really one of the greatest rabbis in Eretz Yisrael, I looked again at what he wrote, and I still affirm what I say, not to pay attention to what the Chazon Ish says. He tells Rabbi Levenstein, in his letter to Rabbi Chisel Levenstein, Rav Kislev says, we can't change the day of Shabbos. So quite apart from it being a mistake to do it, what will the masses think? You know, they'll see some people observing Shabbos on Sunday, others not. It'll totally destroy Shabbos in their eyes. One wonders what Rav Kislev would have, how he would have reacted had he known that Rav Simcha Zella Grieger, the Dayan of Brisk, said that in Harbin, Jews should avoid Torah prohibitions on Sunday, because Rav Simcha Zella even thought that that was a problem. Okay, now once the yeshiva leaves Kobe for Shanghai in September 41, the dispute ceases to be a practical matter because they got out. And in China, there's no question, other than Rav Simcha Zelig, who thought that maybe there's a question. Everyone assumes that in China, Shabbos is Saturday. However, we know that some Mir students were not able to get out. For one reason or another, they remained. And Yom Kippur came the evening of September 30th. And this is what Yecheskel Leitner says. Some of them observed 2 days of complete Yom Kippur fasting. Others kept the fast for just 1 day, and on the other day followed certain halachic modifications. That means pachos kashir. And I heard that from my teacher, Rebbe in JC, in 9th and 10th grade, Rav Shlomovitz, that there were some people who did pachos kashir, that is, you can eat a little bit every few minutes. And in Rav Herzog's telegram or letter to them, he says, do not change the day, but if you're going to fast, you know, on the second, it can't be a complete fast because that's dangerous. This concern over when Yom Kippur is significant for another reason, because there were Jews, there were yeshiva students in in Shanghai. They went to Shanghai, and then visas came in for them for both America and Canada. And they did not leave. And he doesn't tell us they didn't leave because they wanted to be with the yeshiva, which is why others didn't leave. The reason Rav Leib Malin says they didn't leave is because it was the boat was supposed to leave the day before Yom Kippur. They didn't know when they'd be on the boat what day to observe Yom Kippur. So instead of putting themselves in that situation, they remained in Shanghai. Now, of course, they probably thought that fine, we'll get another boat, not knowing that Pearl Harbor was not that far away, and then they'd be stuck there. But at least then, at the end of September 1941, the fear of not knowing when Yom Kippur was enough to keep them from taking this opportunity, because they had a visa to leave. I see it's already 9:30. We just arrived in Shanghai, so we got to talk about they arrive in Shanghai. Where are they supposed to go? Where are they supposed to learn? Is the yeshiva building waiting for them? It's almost as if God, and this is what the yeshiva said, God prepared everything in advance. Wait till you hear what was waiting for them in mint condition. And we have a lot to talk about. But let me go through the questions and comments here. As always, next week we'll pick up I'll go through all the ones, the public and the private ones. Fisher says he's surprised there's no older Sephardic yeshivas than the Mir. I actually, when I made that, I was thinking of Ashkenazic yeshivas, but what Sephardic yeshivas are there? Beit El. There's sort of yeshiva Beit El in Jerusalem that goes back a couple hundred years. But it's really not a yeshiva like we think of. It's like a small group. So maybe that would be older than. That would be the only one. Shara Shamayim and Parat Yosef are not older. Yes, so B says Rav Yonah Minsker, exactly. Yeah. But you had the Beit El yeshiva, which I believe in some form still exists. But again, it's not really the same thing as far as I know. Okay, well, that's it. Beit El. So Eli Abadi, thank you very much. Without even seeing it, I said that the yeshiva of Mekubali in Beit El is already from the... But it's a different sort of yeshiva. But okay, yes, that's very nice. I guess I should, I hadn't even thought of it, but that's the one. That's the one, if you go there, you can see them wearing two sets of tefillin, head tefillin at one time, which is the old way of doing it, the old Sephardic approach, which shows you, of course, they couldn't have these giant tefillins that have become popular in the last 50 years. You're supposed to have enough to put two on. Yes, thank you. Okay, Eli Abadi, I read it out loud because people listen and they have to hear it. They study everything with specialization of Kabbalah. It's a yeshiva. They teach it. Okay, it is a yeshiva. It's a yeshiva where people are studying Torah. It's definitely a yeshiva. Definitely. It's not a yeshiva in the Ashkenazic sense. I mean, people will be studying there their whole life. We think of the yeshiva. We think of people from the age of whatever, 15 to 25, and then they get married and they leave. That's different. Okay, but it is a yeshiva, definitely. Someone asks, I'm surprised about the opposition of Rav Wasserman to Rav Chaim Moser urging rabbis to go back to their community since there's a story that he went to Baranovich even though he was in America when war broke. No, he didn't go to Baranovich when war broke. He went to Baranovich months before the war. This is some, for some reason, you can listen to my classes on Rav Chanan. The legend developed that Rav Chanan Wasserman went back to Europe during war to die with his students, all sorts of nonsensical things. He went back, I think it was March of 1939. He did not go back when war broke. Now, Rav Avram Dovber Shapiro, he came back from Switzerland. Yes, he did come back from Switzerland. That's true. But there's no reason to assume at the time, remember, it was an independent country. Coming back from Switzerland is no different to going to Switzerland. These are independent countries, neutral countries. No one had any thoughts at the time that, just like they didn't think Switzerland was going to be overrun, they didn't think Lithuania was going to be overrun. Switzerland ends up being the only neutral country, well, that in Sweden, not overrun. So there wasn't any thoughts when the Dvar Avraham goes back that he's putting his life in danger. Yes, thank you. Okay, you, Shmuley, and Eli Abadi, you can have your debates online, but I agree that it is a, Beit El is a yeshiva. It's definitely against the, definitely a yeshiva, different type of yeshivas. You can communicate privately as well. Where's the tshuva from Nathan? Since someone asked me on the dateline, I'll have to get back to you on that. I'll get back to you next class. I don't remember if it's in the Shoal Meshiv. That's where Molivers is. I'll report that next class. Unless it's not a tshuva, unless it's just a reporting what he says. Eyal Barak's family roots are in Lithuania, if I remember correctly. But his parents come from Harbin. No one's from Harbin originally. They all made it to Harbin. Oh, and someone privately sent me that Omer's father is actually buried in Harbin. And they do, Jack says, a famous winter ice festival. Yes. The problem is the cemeteries, you can't go visit the cemeteries. I tried to visit in Shanghai. The Chinese have destroyed all the cemeteries. Too many people there, you can't have cemeteries. Someone says that Mir Yeshiva printing press Sfarim. Yes, I will talk next class or the class after all about the Sfarim printed in the Mir Yeshiva, all the Sfarim they printed. Jack says, Oaleya Sifrei Torah, both Ashkenazic and Sephardic style. And he says he's duchened an Oaleya on weekdays. That's good to hear, Jack, but I didn't know if you knew that was the only Ashkenazic show in the world. I said this, and no one has contradicted me yet, so I think it's okay. let's see. Ramosha Feinstein spoke against taking the books. He has. He was asked about taking the books from JTS, and he said that you're not allowed to. It's not a. Well, I can tell you right now, my next foreign blog post in the Masoras Moshe. Masoras Moshe is Rabbi Mordechai Tenler's recordings of all the things he heard. There is, it's really interesting because they have a, it's his notes which were sent to Israel, and they put them together and put out these books with all sorts of great stuff. What his notes said was, can you, my last post, I quoted Ramosha saying, you absolutely cannot take books from the seminary. In the next post, I'm going to quote you something else interesting. Ramosha was asked, can you send copies of your books to the seminary? And he replied, what's the problem? They have a lot of Sfarim there. The people who prepared it in Israel didn't know what the seminary was. So as the title, they say, can you donate Sfarim to a Catholic seminary? Well, that's not what Ramosha's talking about. No one's talking about Catholic seminaries, but they didn't know what, anyone who grew up in New York knows the seminary. It's not a Catholic seminary. There's only one seminary. Some people even call it the cemetery. They didn't like it. Someone points out that they wanted the Jews to leave Kobe, which is an industrial military city. The Japanese knew that they were soon going to enter the war. That's the reason they give. Others give a reason. Basically, they didn't want these foreigners on Japanese soil. There was also suspicion that they could be Russian spies, all sorts of things. I believe this Monty Berger, I believe, found her being al-Shas. I don't know what that means. The Sfas MS found her being al-Shas.
I mean, it was his commentary on the Shas, probably.
No. Yeah. Well, what was it? I have to look at it. I forget now. It's been a while since I looked at it. Yes, it's on Kutchin. In fact, in one of the areas, it was missing words, and they were able to reconstruct some of the words. Someone privately emails me that his father and two others left Shanghai on December 4th, 1941, and they hit Manila, and the boat was bombed, and they were imprisoned at Japanese POW camps. But M. Soroka, he asks me that. He mentions that, but I want to tell you something. I want to show you something, I'm prepared, because what I was going to show you today, but instead I'll show you next class. Let me find it here. Is this. Take a look at this. But this will be for next class. Mirror in Manila. Amir Yeshuvin students, amazing survival, escape and survival. So yes, I will tell it, but I don't need to tell it. If the author is on, I know he has I'll give the link next time. You can watch a whole video of him telling the story. I just was going to mention that, but this is going to relate to the whole issue of do you leave or not. Some people had visas and they left. Rav Yecheskel Levenstein did not want people to leave. He thought it was important for the yeshiva to remain together. But yeah, I'll mention the Mirror of Manila. It's unbelievable. I don't know what to say. You know, we're done. Thank you all for coming. But I'm speaking about things, and I can tell you from the private texting I get, there's got to be 10 people here whose parents either themselves are born in Shanghai or parents. We have authors here. We have others. So I don't think I've ever had a class like this. But we've only, as the song says, we've only just begun. We've now have made it to Shanghai, and we shall continue next week. Thank you all. See you next week, everyone.
Thank you very much. Okay, tomorrow morning, Marty Lakshin, those from Toronto know him very well. He'll be talking on Rashi, a four-part series on medieval Parshanim. And in the evening, Miriam Kripke, the Dean of Faculty at Ramaz, will be speaking on the prophet and the priest. So that's tomorrow, 11 and 8:30 at regular time. Wednesday, Yom Ha'atzmaut, we're going to have a shiur at 12 o'clock, not our regular time. Rabbi Lee Bachman, who is the head of school at Shat, where I teach in Toronto, made Aliyah years ago, is going to talk about extraordinary meetings with ordinary Israelis, something along those lines. That'll be 12 o'clock Yom HaSmut. Our regular schedule back Thursday, you know, 11 in the morning, 8:30 at night. Then I speak 9:30 Friday morning on Prekevot. Next Sunday, Rabbi Adam Mintz will be starting a series. Just follow the emails, and everybody be well, be safe, and Lila Tov. Nice to see you all, and nice to see all the faces of so many people.
And Josh, someone texted me that the picture of Omert's parents, I guess, Matseva. Yes, if you can send that to me, I'd love to see it, because I'm surprised even it survives. When I went in Shanghai, I couldn't find, everything was destroyed. You know, maybe Harbin is not as crowded as Shanghai, but they don't bury people in China. If you bury people there, you'd run out of space very quickly. So it's not so simple. There's a whole, if you go to Shanghai and you take the tour with, there's an Israeli tour guide there. I think his name is Devere. You learn all about what he's done. He's uncovered tombstones from all over the city. He wants to open up a whole museum. I'll tell the story about contemporary Shanghai at the end, I guess. Okay, good night, everyone.
Okay, Lila Tov, everybody.